So now, ladies and gentlemen, it is start time. Are you ready for start time?
From WBEZ Chicago and PRX, this is Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. This week, we take a refresher course on new wave music with Lori Majewski, co-author of Mad World, an oral history of new wave artists and the songs that defined the 1980s.
You know, what Vince Clarke did to program the music for early Depeche Mode, there were no sounds presets in those keyboards back in the day. This was truly forward-thinking stuff.
And we're joined by singer Alison Moyet, who got her start in synth-pop group Yaz, but has since had a really rich and rewarding solo career.
That's all coming up on Sound Opinions.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island Beer Company, brewers of Goose IPA, Four Star Pils, Sophie Farmhouse Ale, and Bourbon County Brand Stout. More at gooseisland.com. We don't need to be the only beer you drink. We just want to be the best beer you drink.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and later on we're going to interview Alison Moyet, who was in that great new wave band Yaz with Vince Clarke, who went on to form Erasure. But Moyet herself had an incredible career as a solo artist after that.
Incredible voice, Greg. That's later in the show. But first, we thought a new wave primer was in order.
That's Duran Duran with the 1982 hit Rio, an iconic track by an iconic band that really captures a specific time and place. If you heard that song, you knew where you were and where you heard it, probably MTV. When you hear that song, you're immediately taken back to that 1980s new wave era.
I'll confess, Greg, that in the 80s, I had a band called The Interns, who were very new wave. I had the skinny tie and everything. We covered not one, but two Flock of Seagulls songs, I Ran and Telecommunication. Little inconsistent, though. We also played Rush's 2112.
You know, the fact that you make that sound almost like a confession as opposed to an admission, Jim, says a lot about the way some people view new wave. It's sort of put in that same category as disco for some people. New wave music doesn't get a lot of respect in some circles. It does get a lot of respect here, though. Our guest Lori Majewski would note there's more to new wave than one-hit wonders and those strange haircuts.
Absolutely, Greg. Lori and co-author Jonathan Bernstein wrote a swell book, Mad World, an oral history of new wave artists and the songs that define the 1980s. And we spoke with Lori about new wave in 2014, starting the conversation with a definition. What is new wave? To me, it's the era right after punk in New York. Talking Heads, The Cars, Skinny Ties. But for Lori, the story starts in the UK.
Yes, people in the UK don't really love the term new wave. To them, it may mean more, like you said, skinny ties, like Elvis, Costello, even Talking Heads. Over in the UK, they called it new pop. Mm. And we really define it as the time from, say, right post-punk, like 1977, 78, through until Band Aid and Live Aid, we see as the end of the era. And it was a time that really, it feels like record companies and record label people were off duty because they let let these bands do whatever they wanted. There were no A&R guys. There were no wardrobe stylists. At this point, these punks, they wanted something else. Punk, as you know, in the UK lasted really only for about a year. And the people who were the original punks, they got bored really quickly, especially when the masses embraced punk like they did. So they were looking for an outlet, and bands like Joy Division formed in Modern English. On the one hand, they were like the more rock-driven bands. And then you had, on the other, punks like Gary Numan and the guys in the Human League saying, you know what, we're going to go in the direction of Kraftwerk.
Here in my car, I feel safest of all. I can lock all my doors. It's the only way to live in cars.
you started by saying that this era doesn't get a lot of respect. And I can tell you, Durantys do not get a lot of respect. Growing up in Weehawken, New Jersey, all I wanted in my whole life was to meet Duran Duran. And you know, I was reading smash hits and star hits at the time, and I thought, oh gosh, maybe if I became a journalist, I can actually fulfill that dream of meeting John Taylor and Simon Le Bon, Nick Rhodes. You know, we here in the United States, we didn't have the full effect of David Bowie, or I hadn't ever heard of Roxy Music. So when Gary Numan appears on my television set on MTV, one of the very first videos I ever saw was Cars, I thought he was the most original thing I'd ever seen in my life. It was like space aliens had landed in my home. That's what it was like. And it was the music, the sound, the audio, but it was also the visual. And I think that's why it shook me up the way it did.
So the three ingredients here, really, like you said earlier, new technology, the synthesizers coming in, this particular, the digital synthesizers, a new audience, right? Punk had shown the record companies that there was a new young audience out there that didn't want, you know, the Allman Brothers anymore, or Yes, or Genesis. There was something new in the air, but hopefully they could be managed a little easier than those nasty Sex Pistols. And then this new technology, MTV, a platform for this stuff.
Right. It was a total accident, because if there had been ample videos for the likes of REO Speedwagon, we really would never have seen these weird guys coming over from the UK wearing eyeliner and lipstick. They were looking to alternative radio. They're like, oh my gosh, maybe we should start playing the stuff that channels like K-Rock in LA and LIR here in New York, maybe we should be playing those videos.
You know, in the indie underground that was happening just down the hill from you, from Weehawken in Maxwell's and such, right? This stuff was considered very commercial, but it was revolutionary in a different way. Suddenly, people of alternative sexualities are showing up on your TV. There's a quote in the book from Alison Moyet of Yaz that crystallizes it for me, and she says, looking back to the 80s, there was so much more room for diversity. A freak was more celebrated than it is now. And from this distance now, you know, Bob Moldenpohl, Westerberg are freaks just like Alison Moyet, or dare I say it, that guy in A Flock of Seagulls.
Well, in the UK, which is where Alison is from, you had the whole club scene that really embraced the New Romantic era. And the New Romantic, that was like a year over in the UK. But you had Spandau Ballet, that was the house band for the Blitz, which was kind of like, you know, a couple of years past Studio 54 here in New York. They had people dressing up like they were like Greek goddesses, and guys wearing makeup. And suddenly, after that Blitz club became so popular, all around the UK, you had mini Blitz clubs. And that's how Duran Duran came to be. You know, you had Birmingham wanting to be that way as well. And so actually Spandau Ballet came before Duran Duran. And in a lot of ways, maybe Duran wouldn't even exist if not for Spandau Ballet paving that way for them.
Why do I find it hard to write the next line? Oh, I want the truth to be
in your book, you go through some of the iconic bands and songs of 80s new wave, but let's start with Duran Duran. You call yourself a Durani, unapologetic about it. Why are they so special, and what holds up today?
Well, as we say in the book, they are the Rolling Stones of this era. Here we are, 30-something years later. They're still recording. And it's interesting, for a long time, as I said earlier, Durantys were kind of like, you know, we didn't get any respect. We were the Rodney Dangerfield of fans. You know, when I loved the Smiths, everybody was like, oh, your literary quotient goes up when you love the Smiths. There was nothing, you know, I didn't get slagged off for loving the Smiths. But for Duran, it was one of those things that it took years for pop culture to come around to them. And I remember at some time in the mid-2000s, you had Justin Timberlake wanting to work with them and Timbaland. And you had Gwen Stefani and No Doubt saying that they had been such an influence. And suddenly the culture had come around to them. And so now, all these years later, you know, there are guys at the show. I remember when you'd go to a show and the only guy that was there was a dad. People have really realized that beyond the pretty boy good looks and the great videos were some of the best songs to come out of the 80s for sure. They combined the grit of a guitar band and coming out of punk. They had a really strong guitar and drums coming into it, you know, right away. That first album, that first Duran Duran album is very tight. And John Taylor says in the book, you know, they modeled their rhythm section after Chic and after the sound and vision from Bowie. And that's why they came to work with someone like Nile Rodgers, you know, mid through the 80s on Wild Boys and The Reflex. Duran Duran is Mark Ronson's favorite band. And he said, working with them, you're just reminded they are just such good musicians, every single one of them. He basically says, you know, this isn't a song about sex. It is sex.
That's a key point, because punk was not sexy. You know, everybody in punk went as far out of their way as possible to not be sexy. And now here was, 2 years later, these bands that were all about sex.
Well, they wanted to be pop stars. Adam Ant, he was one of the original punks. In fact, Sex Pistols opened up for his band. And even he, as the headliner that night, was so taken with the Sex Pistols that he was like, wow, I'm going to change this thing up. But a year later, they were sick of the spitting. They were sick of the safety pins. They thought it was dirty. And they wanted to be pop stars. And you know, Adam Ant went to his label and was like, you know, we want girls to like us. We want to write pop songs. And they were like, wait, that's not cool. In the end, they sold so many records. You know, Adam Ant went from kind of being a punchline, I mean, no one wanted to sign him as a punk, to being this huge pop star that really paved the way for a lot of the bands in this book.
After a short break, more on the history of New Wave with Lori Majewski. And later, an interview with singer Allison Moyet. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
Sound Opinions is supported by Dark Matter Coffee, an importer and roaster of direct-sourced coffees, offering a variety of signature blends and barrel-aged selections at darkmattercoffee.com. Dark Matter Coffee. Get freshly roasted.
Looking from a window above, it's like a story of love. Yesterday, I'm moving farther away. Won't you need me? was the love you gave. All I needed for another day, and all I ever knew, only you. Sometimes when I think of her name.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner with the Flock of Seagulls haircut over there is Greg Kot, and that is the 1982 hit Only You by Yaz. The group was a major player on the new wave scene in the UK, and we'll talk to one of its members, Alison Moyet, later in the show. Right now, we're talking about new wave with Lori Majewski, whose book, Mad World, gives an oral history of that period. We were talking about synths earlier. Let's talk about another band, Human League. You mentioned them. In my biography of Lester Bangs, many people have remarked upon the fact that Dare was the album that was on Lester's turntable when he died. You know, as if Human League killed Lester Bangs. You know, I actually think he would have liked it. I remember buying the Don't You Want Me Baby single with Seconds on the B-side. I loved it.
Human League were two completely different groups. I mean, we give the story of the very beginning with Being Boiled, and along with Warm Leatherette and Kraftwerk, that's the beginning of the New Wave era. But of course, by the time Human League reached our shores in my teenage years, it was an ABBA-esque band with this, you know, Don't You Want Me song that was such a juggernaut. Song really brought new wave to America. I think Lester would have loved it because he was very forward-thinking, and that's what new wave was. When you think about New Order and Blue Monday and how that changed the face of music. And by the way, Bernard Sumner says in the book, the way they made that song, they needed a, quote, scientist to program the sequencers.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this was not easy stuff. I think new wave gets a lot of shtick because of the synthesizer, because it's not real sounds. It's not someone physically playing a guitar. But, you know, what Vince Clark did to program the music for early Depeche Mode, there were no sounds presets in those keyboards back in the day. This was truly forward-thinking stuff.
Talking with Lori Majewski about New Wave here on Sound Opinions. And Lori, obviously on one end of the serious artist spectrum, you've got Human League and Yaz, groups with lots of substance and still lauded by critics. And then on the other hand, you have A-ha, which is basically the epitome of a one-hit wonder. And when people talk about the disposable nature of some of this music, they may think of a band like A-ha. I do believe they have Norway's one and only still international chart hit with Take On Me.
all, they actually had a 20-something year career. But maybe a band like Kaja Goo Goo, which actually only put out one record, Too Shy.
Cause you're too shy, shy, hush, hush, I do I. Too shy, shy, hush, hush, I do I.
Too Shy, produced by Nick Rhodes of Duran Duran. And we ended up giving them a ton of pages in this book. They just had a very dramatic story. They kicked their singer, Lamal, out at the height of their fame. I mean, what band does that? When you think, oh, one hit wonder, but that one hit was one of the greatest bass lines of any new wave song. So I like to think that even, you know, the one hit wonders in this book have a lot of merit.
Some of these stories are so poignant because as you look at it now, as we look at the dying carcass rotting of the music industry, you know, this was the kind of the last gasp of the big old, we'll sign you, we'll make you a star, and then we'll dispose of you and you won't have had made a dime, you know, of it. Right? New wave musician after new wave musician just told you about how it was this great ride and then it was over and now they're like working at Jiffy Lube.
Well, 30 years on, a lot of these guys, I don't think that they're working at Jiffy Lube, but as Chris Butler from The Waitresses recently told me, he couldn't put his kid through Harvard, but he could put him through a decent state school.
I know what boys like. I know what guys want.
You mentioned the longevity of some of these songs. You know, a great example of that is a band you write about extensively in the book, Tears for Fears. Gary Jules' cover of Mad World completely revived that song, but also brought the band back into prominence. Now they're once again together and recording some new music.
All around me are familiar faces, worn out places, worn out faces, bright and early for the daily races, going nowhere, going nowhere. Their tears are filling up.
What I find so interesting about that band is that they didn't talk for 10 years. Right after Sowing the Seeds of Love, after being together for like 15 years, you know, it's hard when you're in a duo. You only can hate the other person after a while. And that's what happened. And it's interesting. It took at least 10 years for Kurt and Roland to start talking again. And I think that the Gary Jules version really helped to make them realize what a strong back catalog they have.
All around me are familiar faces, worn out places, worn out faces, bright and early for their daily races, going nowhere, going nowhere.
I think they paled in comparison with some critics to, say, Morrissey or Pet Shop Boys. You know, they were these heavy songs, melancholy vibe. You know, they were advocates of primal scream therapy, I guess. But now you look back and you go, man, a lot of this stuff was pretty catchy. And Roland Orzabal and Kurt Smith are kind of now, I think, getting some late career recognition as these better-than-average songwriters. To me, Tears for Fears is a very different band than Duran Duran. Did you appreciate them in their time?
I did. I remember thinking they were quite sullen. and I do remember thinking that, I mean, that record, Songs from the Big Chair, was one of probably the biggest album of any of these bands. And I remember thinking they were very played out, that Shout was all over the radio.
Shout, shout.
But years later, I mean, now, does a week go by that I don't hear Everybody Wants to Rule the World on the radio? No, and I never turn the station.
We will find you acting on your best behavior. Turn your back on Mother Nature.
pretty interesting. When I was talking to Roland Orzabal, he said that he was listening to the radio and Girls on Film was actually on the radio when he sat down to write Mad World. And he thought, why is that such an upbeat song, you know, Girls on Film, and here I am writing this sad, sullen song. And that's the thing. You have to remember there were two very different types of bands to come out of New Wave. You had the very upbeat, colorful bands like Duran Duran, like Culture Club. And then you had these bands like New Order and Tears for Fears. I mean, New Order, yes, they're a dance band, but those lyrics are dark. So some bands, they responded to the 80s and Thatcherism and, you know, the constant threat of nuclear annihilation. They responded to it with, well, we're going to dance through it. You know, and some, like Tears for Fears, were like, we don't see what there is to be so happy about.
Lori Majewski is the co-author of Mad World, an oral history of new wave artists and the songs that defined the 1980s. Lori, thanks for chatting with us on Sound Opinions.
Oh, this was amazing. Thank you.
Now we want to hear from you. What music do you fondly remember from the new wave era? Let us know on our hotline, 888-859-1800, or reach out to us on Twitter or Facebook. When we come back, we'll talk to Alison Moyet, an artist that got her start in the new wave scene, or the new pop scene, as the Brits called it. And since then, she's never stopped evolving. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot. He's Jim DeRogatis. And that's a little bit of our guest this week, Alison Moyet, singing that song, Situation. As we talked about earlier, Moyet got her start in the early 80s as the lead singer in the British synth-pop duo Yaz, alongside Vince Clarke, who had just left Depeche Mode. The thing about, well, there are many things to like about Yaz, but what I loved about them was that minimalist sound. Clarke did these really stark arrangements with synthesizers, with machines essentially. Mm-hmm. And then you had this amazing voice over the top of it. Basically a soul singer singing with these machines. And the contrast there with the melodies and the music was just extraordinary. Yaz made two very successful records in the UK, Upstairs at Eric's and You and Me Both. And then the band broke up in 1983, and Alison embarked on a very fruitful solo career.
Absolutely, Greg. Her debut album, ALF, came out a year later, and she's continued to make great records ever since. I've been a fan of hers since the beginning. I think that that powerful, soulful voice, that empowered feminist perspective, Greg, I think she is a force of nature, and it's hard not to be sucked up in that energy. In mid-2017, she released yet another great album, Other, which is a record we'll talk about in a bit. But first, I started the conversation talking about Yaz. I wanted to know about the differences between her and her Yaz bandmate, Vince Clarke, and what happened that band ended so soon.
We're very different. You know, I come from this French peasant family, and we have no problem expressing ourselves. Table thumping is a lot of passion, but we don't hang on to anything. You know, don't bear grudges. He was that very English family, which is, you know, everything's not laid out. Everything is kind of held back and brewed upon, you know. So it wasn't a good combination. And then also when he'd split up with Depeche, you know, it was a sad time for him. This was his first band. These were his, you know, school year friends and, you know, the first experience to share. It's like a marriage breaking up. He wasn't really looking for another relationship. I was the transition. He wanted to prove a point with only you, you know.
And you were just, the rebound.
I was the rebound, yeah. I was just the, I don't need you.
Looking from a window above, it's like a story of love. Can you hear me? Came back only yesterday. I'm moving farther away. Won't you near me? All I needed was the love you gave. All I needed for another day. And all I ever knew, only you.
I'd been playing in bands before any of them in Basildon, you know. I was in the same class as Fletcher and Martin Gore at school and later Dave Garn at college. And Vince I knew the least well, actually. But he knew what my voice was like when he'd written the song and so just asked me to come and demo it. And as far as I was concerned, that's all that was going to be happening, demo.
Yeah, and then it led to stardom and two successful records, right?
Yeah.
And then the whole bit, right?
Although
we'd
already split up before we started writing, you and me both. That only happened really because his publisher said, look, you keep doing well and then, you know, jump in ship, at least sort of like try and get a little bit of a, you know, a little bit of carpet under your foot. And so I think he only did it for that reason.
So, Alf, your debut album comes out in 84, and it's a huge hit in the UK. It's an extremely exciting thing to have this successful solo album, but did you feel pressure to keep making Alf Part 2 and Part 3 and 4 and 5?
You know, I enjoyed the experience of it, but I'm a suck it and see kind of person. It's like, I like trying things. You know, I am a doer rather than a consumer. And that relates to all things in my life. If I want something in my life, I try and participate at it, you know. So I made the Alf album, and that was a really interesting way. It was a different way to make an album than I had with Vince. That was like, great. Oh, that was interesting. Never at any point in time thinking that is who I intend to be. Or even that I'd have a career that would last 35 years beyond that. And and that was who I was, you know, wanted to be. And, you know, our voices change. And I'm a lyric writer and I write from experience and from, you know, personal feelings. And those things change. Your sentiments change. And you have a different voice and different narrative as you get older. And some of the whining that I would have done as a kid, you know, I'm not a whiny person. You know, it's like I'm a bit inured to it. I was very influenced by Janis Joplin, you know, as a kid. And so, you know, before I'd even, you know, snogged a boy, you know, it was like a case of, you know, I wanted my heart broken before I ever wanted to fall in love, because that kind of crying into the wind seems so much more appealing, you know.
Yeah.
The Janis Joplin torment. I mean, I remember being 16 and buying some rum because I heard that she drank rum and trying to become an alcoholic so that I could be like Janis, you know. And the thing is, I never liked the taste of it, you know. And I remember my mum just looking at me and just, you know, just shook her head. And it was just that derision as opposed to fury that made, oh, this isn't a rebellion, is it? Even my mother's not impressed.
Well, that, you know, isn't it tragic, Alison, that romantic myth, live hard, die young, you know, abuse yourself.
Yeah.
You know, it persists and young people are seduced by it. Isn't it cooler to be, I mean, you're now like 56, right?
Yeah. I was just counting. I was thinking, am I 57 yet? No, but I think I'm 56. Yeah.
61, okay, you know, yeah. I mean, it's cooler to be 57 and still be making the sort of music.
Yeah, but the thing is that this is kind of an interesting thing. It's just that young people, they're constantly told that the best part of their life is when they're young. Well, you couldn't give me my 20s pickled. I was miserable. I was dark and miserable and stultified, you know. as a middle-aged woman, and even young people go, 56, like, that's middle-age, you're older than middle-age. It's like, well, whatever you want to call it, mate. But, you know, don't mess in your own bed, because if you're lucky, you'll be this age. And then you're going to be moaning about some young, you know, some young git giving you an hard time about it. But but the point of the matter is you live life better when you're older, because you're more sound, you're not susceptible to other people's influences, you're not as fragile, you know. It's a good place to be, I like it.
You and your song is new. Go, lover, go. I already know. Until you give to what I'm heard. Go, lover, go. Go, go.
Well, we've had a couple of references already of people expecting you to make music a certain way.
Yeah.
So the title track is Extraordinary, Other, and I hear you're going to play it for us.
Yeah, I mean, Other is like you say, the title track, and yet represents the rest of the album probably less than anything else, as it's the most stripped down me and Guy on piano. Other really talks about me and many other people feel like we've been, you know, separate from the mainstream of society. And yet in that separateness, we have this place where we come together, where we can understand one another's language. And at the same time, the sorrow we feel about the fact that we speak differently.
I don't know precisely which day coloured me other. Perchance it may have been a slow play, so I cut out whichever shape I need. I don't sue for rescue. I'm as free as I have ever been. Don't want another rock to hang about my neck. You see bejeweled, I see bedecked in dead stars. And nothing touching me, nothing touching me. I don't want to look upon another word this dear, so lightly spent, and what says here means came and went. It sounds familiar. Nothing's touching me. Nothing's touching me.
Al Alison Moyet with John Garden and Sean McGee backing her up. Other live on Sound Opinions. Extraordinary stuff. You seem like someone who now no longer worries about compromising.
Yeah, well, I never worried about compromising. I didn't compromise, you know, not after, you know, maybe one year I tried it, you know, and I just realized I couldn't make, you know, when you're standing up on stage and singing a song you don't feel good about, think, enough now, you know. But our voices change. What strikes you as important when you're 16, it's not the same thing when you're older. And so the only way I can liken it is a bit like an ex-husband, you know. Mm. It's like, you know, this was a brilliant person. You really had a fantastic time with them, but you both moved on, and you know there'll be a brilliant partner to someone else. You just never want to sleep with them again.
Yeah,
it's just like that. And there's not, you know,
been there, done that.
Yeah, you've been there and done that, and they're perfectly worthy of love. It's just that your eyes are somewhere else now. If I have to just dial it in, I will not do it. And there are a couple of songs that I cannot do it for that reason.
Yeah.
I won't do A Week in the Presence of Beauty, and I won't do Invisible. Mm-hmm. And that's caused a lot of...
people love Invisible.
Well, and they've got every right to do it. But for me, I can't do it for a couple of reasons. I've gotten older, so this whole kind of whining about a man thing, it just doesn't sit. You know, like, you know, it does not sit with me.
Yeah.
And then beyond that, I've become more and more entrenched in my Europeanness, you know. And we all know that, you know, young British singers, when they first start singing, you know, you take on this Midwest drawl that it is not ours, you know. And that song, written by Lamont Dozier, very American, a great writer,
it's as American
great song.
As American songwriting
it's,
guest,
it's
yeah.
as American as you can get. And so for me to sing that song, I have to put on such a dishonest hat that I can't, you know, I'm not a covers act.
Trying to figure out how to segue into this question. So when people write hate mail to me about a review they've disagreed, they always start out, dear fat, fill in the curse word.
Right.
And it always strikes me as like, you think maybe I haven't noticed, you know, until age 53.
Exactly. It's like, gee, you know, I never guessed.
You know,
I never guessed I carried some weight.
Right.
Do you know what? It's fantastic because you've really hurt me because I've never heard that word before.
Where did you come up with that?
And I'm what crushed. They don't get is that when you've heard it as many times as we will have heard it, it's like, it's just a descriptive word. And it's like, I'll use it about myself because, do you know, it's not an insult. It's just a fact.
Yeah.
Big bird. Do you know what I mean? And? Do you know what I mean?
It's like, you know, a big bird, yes.
It's like, you know, it's like, you know, and also it's not like it's unusual state. This just happens to us in media world. It's mate, look in the mirror.
Yeah.
Look in the mirror. Yeah. I've got things I could tell you about yourself. I'm not going to because I know that you're more vulnerable than I am.
Yeah. You were, as you said, a physical presence.
Yes.
You know, circa the early days, Alf and Yazoo. And of course, A, being a woman in music or any sort of entertainment, you've got that cross to bear, right? You know, we expect you to live up to this body image and be a sort of... And then being a larger woman, right? And now being a middle-aged woman, as you say. And, you know, one of the things I find so inspiring about your music is it's never seemed to make any difference to you as an artist, to your fans, and certainly not to the art.
No, it doesn't. It makes a difference to the media. It makes a difference to certain people who engage with music because they see it as some kind of glitter to their lifestyle. They see it as a badge wearing.
It's an accoutrement to your groovy lifestyle.
Yeah, it's not cool because you're not feeling it, you know. Yeah. And to me, someone that's really cool is someone that can stand alone, iconoclastic, and say, this is who I am. I don't need your approval.
You know, I think if I had to choose one word to describe much of the songwriting you've done, all of it, through the whole, it's storytelling. You really seem interested in telling stories, and you want to tell the stories you're interested in now.
Well, I'm telling the stories that I see. And this is the great thing about this last album. I mean, I changed my life massively a few years back. I lived in the big house in the country where I didn't recognise my neighbours from one 10 years to the next. You know, I just you didn't see them. You went in through your gated drives, and I just had enough of this lifestyle. I burnt all my belongings. I trashed everything, all my gold discs, all my history.
Really,
everything.
Complete purging.
I purged everything. My itineraries, my stage clothes.
You could have sold them on eBay.
I didn't want to sell them on eBay. Do you know what I mean? It's like I could have sold them on eBay, but that you know, you're sitting there talking about nostalgia being the death. That's saying, I am at an end. I have ended here by my life. And there's some things that just aren't for sale.
Right.
It's just not for sale. I'm not for sale. I've never been for sale. Got rid of the house, got rid of the big car, got rid of everything, and moved into a terrace in Brighton. I've got no off-street parking. I walk everywhere. And instead of being this person that all my life has been observed, has always been remarkable, and I'm not saying that as a compliment. People have always had something to say about me, you know, like saying the fat girl or the big girl, the girl was built to pull a cart, the girl that's too aggressive, all these kind of things, you know. Suddenly I'm in the background and I'm able to observe, and I can write about what I see, and the empathy I feel about my fellow man and young people trying to understand themselves. I describe what I see, and I'm finding that really thrilling.
I'm wondering, a young woman who says, Aunt Allison,
yes,
I'm not conventionally beautiful.
Yeah.
I'm fatter, or I'm tall, I'm geeky, I'm whatever, you know, but I love to sing and I believe I can make it as a singer.
Right.
Because you not only didn't take the industry's advice or way to push you, but you didn't take conventional society's either.
No. Well, what I say to everyone is when people say to me, I want to become a singer, I say, sing then. And, you know, if you're asking me how you become a famous singer, I can't tell you that.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, but the point of the matter is, if this is truly what you want to do, then it's irrelevant whether you're playing to 10 people in that club or whether you're singing to 10 million. You know, you have to be coming from this from an earnest point of view. To wanting to be famous is not enough.
No.
You know, even wanting to sing is not enough, because, you know, the world is inundated with great vocal talent.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I know, just by watching X Factor, that vocal talent is not enough. It's not enough. Having a great voice is not enough.
Yeah.
You have to have some other angle to you. And it can't be something that you've just conjured up or been cynical about.
It's not a gimmick.
It's not a gimmick.
Have you got to say?
It's not about my granny's dying and I'm singing for her. It's like, no one gives a everyone's granny dies.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You know, and it's like, I can't bear that. I can't bear all that nonsense. I'm singing for them. No, you're not. You're singing for yourself. Let's be honest about that. We do this for ourselves.
Yeah.
This is a selfish pursuit. I didn't sing for my kids. If my kids are, you know, my kids will be saying, stay home.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? We're doing it for ourselves. Let's not play games with this.
Well,
you
sing, or people who want to write, sing or write because they can't imagine not doing it. Just same way as they can't imagine not eating or breathing.
I can imagine. I can imagine not doing it plenty.
Really? You
plenty
can
of times.
Giving it up.
I can. Yeah, I think about it all the time. I can imagine it all the time. I just don't. I just can't. I love singing.
Yeah.
I hate all the rigmarole that goes around it. I hate the fact that I still have to impress upon people, I am not your nostalgia.
Yeah.
You know, or I'm not responsible for your nostalgia. If you feel nostalgia, whatever you feel are your feelings, you've got as much right to them as I have to my own. But it's like, you know, you don't owe me anything. When you want to stop listening to me, you can stop listening to me anytime you like, and you do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can tell that because you can sell millions of records, then you sell hundreds of thousands, then you might sell tens of thousands.
Yeah.
People stop listening to you when they want to do it. They don't owe you. And to the same token, I don't owe anybody singing the material they choose for me.
There are days come be alive here and take up by my side. We decide, let there be no triggers fired.
You're going to play us a song. What are you going to perform, Allison?
We're going to play The Rarest Birds. And this goes on to what we were talking about observing. This is the song that I wrote about Brighton. Now, Brighton, where I live, is a town of great diversity, you know. It's got a big LGBTQ community, trans people, old eccentric people, young people who have no care for wearing feathers. You know, it's like this, it's the real mixture, and diversity really proves itself to be to be something that can function really healthily. And this song, The Rarest Birds, this is me singing about watching these young people, or indeed these old people, coming out into a place where they can feel brave and are accepted and are loved. And I'm, you know, and I'm loving them with this song.
In this town, forget who you are, remembering who you were meant to be. Find yourself bearing easy Mercury's sign, a Eurypsy Sag Club. Is this? It's threat for a party dress. The lines are strung like pounds, so offer your throne, and if we hang, then we hang in the stars. Take my hand and come, be the hostess girl. Skip a grace note on your heel to whichever hymn you please. For the rarest birds are these. Navigate the city walk by dove grey gum constellations. They're the twins and they're the plan. And now I'm at your door, seeing you through your window, fixing your hair, trying not to frown. Like this, and you hold up your party dress. The lights on strings like pearls, let's take on the night, and if we hang, then we hang.
The Rarest Birds by Alison Moyet, live on Sound Opinions. It's been a real treat to have you here. Alison Moyet on Sound Opinions. You can come back anytime.
Oh, that would be lovely. Thank you so much.
That wraps up our conversation with Alison Moyet. If you have thoughts or opinions on Alison, call 888-859-1800 and leave us a message. Greg, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we have an in-depth conversation with the hip-hop artist Vic Mensa, who released one of the best albums of 2017.
People that aren't from Chicago sometimes don't understand how it is that you could be, you know, five blocks from the projects and five blocks from Obama's house. But it's a real thing.
Chicago Saturdays in the park and Sundays in church kept me from off the corner with stones and GDs, was warring and Kings and BDs and VLs. I had dreams of being Jordan, even dope beans was scoring. Swish, trying to be like Mike, shooting through that baseline in their veins.
Greg, we have some thank yous to say on the way out. Colin Ashmi Bobbitt recorded the session with Alison Moyet, and Sound Opinions is produced by Brendan Banasak, Alex Claiborne, and Ayanna Contreras.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So now it's time to hear what you have to say.
Hey guys, this is Karen in Slossmore, Illinois. Ever since you had last year's Valentine's Day special, I've been thinking about how you had your apologies theme, and I was thinking, man, a really great theme would be to have pleading to get back together. So if bands could get back together, if the Sound Opinions fans could all plead for bands to get back together, who would we plead for? And I put in my vote for Uncle Tupelo. Maybe that's a consideration for a future episode. And there's my vote. Thanks so much, guys. Keep up the great work and keep up the wonderful platform for us music fans to be able to voice our opinion. Bye.
Give back the key to my heart and let my love flow like a river straight into your heart, dear.
Hello, lads. This is Greg calling from Lambertville, New Jersey. Thanks for the segment about the recently deceased Rick Hall and the Muscle Shoals music scene. As a heads up to you guys and your listeners, there's a very fine 2013 documentary about the scene titled, appropriately enough, Muscle Shoals. I highly recommend it. Take good care and keep up the good work.
Mustang Sally. Guess you better slow your.
Hi there, my name is Jonathan, and I'm from Atlanta, Georgia. And I just wanted to say how much I enjoyed your show with Sam Beam of Iron and Wine. I'm a huge fan, and it was such a cool interview, and I'm very excited about the new album to get a chance to listen to that. And I did want to leave what I thought was my favorite song. And probably my favorite song of all time is Carousel off of The Shepherd's Dog.
Almost home when I met at the bottom stair. You were braiding your gray hair. It had grown so long since I'd been gone. And the bird...
It's just, Sam is just such an amazing songwriter, artist. He's a poet, he's a storyteller, and for me, that song is just so powerful. I mean, there's really, it's tough to even describe how magical it is. So anyway, thank you so much for that interview and for getting, a chance to hear some of the new album and some of the older songs as well. And love the show. Thank you.
Hi, this is Chris from Chicago, calling about Iron and Wine. Been a big fan of his for years. I'd have to say my favorite song might be House by the Sea. That was off the Shepherd's Dog album.
There's a house by the sea and an ocean between it and me. And like the shape of a wave, then jealous sisters will sing on my grave.
I think it represents a lot about what I like about his music. It's built around this single guitar riff that was dressed up on the album with the band. But you hear it live and it still really holds its own and really sounds great. But most of all about his music, it's the lyrics that I really get into. The storytelling, the imagery, all the interesting metaphors that he puts in there. I'll find myself listening to a song that I've liked for years and then I'll just catch something new or think about it in a different context, and all of a sudden there's this whole other layer of the song that I can appreciate and get into. So anyway, love the show. Thanks.
No more messages.
To share your opinions on Sound Opinions, call 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.